But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The worldwide web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to The Wealth Show, where we discuss the key topics shaping the UK wealth management industry and investors' portfolios. My name is Jack McRae and I'm joined today by Ruffer's Head of Macro Strategy, Mike Biggs. Just over a year ago, Mike joined the UK wealth management firm from GAM, where he had been serving as a macro strategist and portfolio manager. He previously spent time at Deutsche Bank in a number of roles, including serving as an economist and introducing the renowned credit impulse thesis. Welcome, Mike.
Hi, Jack. Thanks very much for having me on your show.
Well, thanks for coming in. And I mean, right now it feels as if we hear constant panic. You know, I speak to wealth managers regularly about record government debt, but are we panicking about the wrong thing?
So this is my view. I think it's entirely appropriate to panic about record government debt. Deficits are high, debt levels are going up, and the concern is valid, right? But what I think this is masking is what's happening on the private sector debt level side, which I think is very important.
Yeah, and your recent report argues the road to prosperity is actually paved with more debt. Can you tell us a bit more why? Yeah.
No, I get that sounds a little counterintuitive, yeah. Right? Given how much public sector debt there is already. But on the private sector, debt always has a negative connotation. But really, when you buy a house, you borrow. When a firm wants to invest, it borrows. So debt is really a crucial part of the business, cycle, right? Now, if you borrow too much, absolutely you can become insolvent, you can have a financial fragility problem. But if you borrow too little, it means that there have been very profitable investment opportunities that have been foregone. And my view is that since the GFC, since the great financial crisis, most of the developed economies in the world have borrowed too little.
Mm-hmm. And how has that lack of private sector borrowing held back global growth since the global financial crisis?
Yeah. So, as I was saying, you know, right, you borrow to spend. Now, normally, borrowing in, say, the US has been around 10, 11, 12% of GDP. Over the last 15 years, it's probably averaged 6 or 7% of GDP. So there's too little spending taking place, too little demand drives too much. You know, you get too little dynamism in the economy, and as a result, you've had weak growth. I think growth's been about 1% lower over the past 15 years in DM than it was in the 15 years before that.
Mm-hmm. And just to be clear, you're suggesting that more debt is good, or is it kind of a more specific type of debt?
In general, on private sector, more borrowing is good. More borrowing is good. Look, you can have too much borrowing, you can have too little borrowing. And so I'm not suggesting you should just borrow as much as you possibly can. I'm just saying that current borrowing levels are lower than really they should be.
Mm-hmm. And we touched on it earlier, but your signature framework, the credit impulse, can you explain to our listeners what exactly it is?
Right. I'll try not to be too long on this one. But I think most people don't care enough about credit. What they do is they compare credit growth to GDP growth, and they see that the two are not that well correlated. And if anything, the credit growth lags the GDP growth. So they disregard it, right? Now, this is the incorrect comparison. Credit's a stock variable. GDP is a flow variable. If you really care about spending today, you should care about your new borrowing today. And if you want to think about spending tomorrow, you should care about your new borrowing tomorrow, right? And if you want strong spending growth, what you've got to do is you've got to borrow more tomorrow than you borrow today, right? And in credit growth terms, that means it doesn't really matter if credit growth is high or low. The crucial thing is credit growth rising or falling, right? And that change in credit growth, that's what we call the credit impulse.
You pointed out that the financial industry often gets credit data completely wrong. And what is kind of the stock flow error?
Yeah, what's the stock flow error? Absolutely. So what I was saying there is what they do is they look at credit growth. Now, credit growth is growth in the stock of credit, right? That's everything you've borrowed to this point, right? What really affects spending, which is a flow concept, is how much you borrow today, right? And so, as I say, you borrow more, and then you'll spend more. Now, what the case is in terms of credit growth is I was saying, look, what really matters is whether credit growth's rising or falling, not whether it's high or low. And the market tends to look at what the level of credit growth is rather than the change. Now, just to give you a sense, this can be quite counterintuitive. If the argument I'm making is correct, right, it means that you can have negative credit growth and strong credit-driven spending growth at the same time. So maybe just to use a numerical example, it might make it more evident, right? Imagine you've got an income of 100. You've got to pay down your debt by 20 in year one. You can spend 80. If in year two, you've still got an income of 100 and you pay down your debt by 10, you can spend 90, right? So your spending is shooting up from 80 to 90, even though your credit growth is negative, right? And so because what's really important is the change in credit growth, but what the market looks at is the level. Well, look, whenever credit growth's high but it's falling, the market tends to be too bullish. And whenever it's low but it's rising, the market tends to be bearish. And those are the opportunities we're trying to look for.
And why does speed of new borrowing really matter more so than kind of the size of the debt?
And the level, yeah. I mean, I think the best way I can explain it is just that little example I've given, right? Let's say I borrow 10 today and I spend it, and I borrow 20 tomorrow and I spend it. My spending goes up by 10, right? And it doesn't matter if my stock of debt at the start was 1 or whether it was 1 million. The increase in 10 is really what drives the spending.
And historically, borrowings bounce back quite hard after recessions. Why didn't that happen after kind of 2008?
No. So you raise an extremely good question, right? Every cycle, what you have is you have a recession, borrowing collapses, you have a recession, borrowing rises, you've got this long period of above trend growth, it gets very high, and then you get some sort of an accident, borrowing falls, and you get the recession again. And after 2008-09, borrowing absolutely collapsed, right? And then it recovered a little bit, but it moved sideways at very, very low levels. And because of that, we never got that big rebound in growth you usually have. Now, your question is, why did that happen, right? And I think there are a couple of reasons. I mean, firstly, it's fair to say that the private sector was too indebted going into the financial crisis. So some reduced level of borrowing seems valid. But I think the two big things are, one, what really boosts borrowing is when you cut interest rates. It's not the level, it's the change in interest rates. Now, interest rates hit their zero lower bound, so they couldn't be cut. And because they couldn't be cut, you never got that rebound in new borrowing. And the other one is, you know, after the financial crisis, given what had happened, it was entirely valid, but regulators came in, and they tightened regulations on banks and banks lending. Right, and it's entirely valid. They wanted to avoid a financial crisis. But I think the outcome has been 15 years of lending that's been too low. It suggests that perhaps those regulations are too tight.
Yeah, and looking kind of more recently, you noted that new borrowing has been stuck around 5% of GDP since the pandemic. What gets us out of this kind of rut?
So one thing that could get you out of the rut, and in both the UK and the US, you see an easing in bank regulations. That's very much where the debate is going. Another thing that I think can get you out of that rut is a fall in interest rates. Now, that doesn't look so likely now with the oil price spike and the rest. But nevertheless, interest rates are relatively high. There is scope for them to come down. And even the declines that have happened already could start to boost lending. And then finally, you just get an upturn in the cycle, because what's happened now is after 15 years of low borrowing, private sector balance sheets have improved. They've got a lot more capacity to borrow. So maybe if growth keeps gaining some momentum, that'll be enough to get the private sector to borrow, to spend, and that will reinforce the growth cycle.
Yeah, and I mean, we talked about the last 15 years, consumers getting on top of debt and kind of be more cautious. Are kind of household balance sheets ready to take on new debt again?
Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult question to answer, but just to say, you had an incredible credit boom from 2000 to 2008, mm-hmm. right? And in the period after that, you have reversed that entire credit boom in terms of debt levels. So certainly, if you're happy to borrow in 2000, from a debt level perspective, there's no reason why you shouldn't be happy to borrow now.
And we touched on deregulation. at the end of last year, the Bank of England eased capital requirements. Is deregulation kind of the green light banks need to start lending more?
Look, I'd say it's just one of the factors. I mean, mm-hmm. there'll be a debate as to how binding the regulation really was on lending. If you look at it in a very simplistic way, you had reasonably high levels of lending, you had the financial crisis, regulation kicked in, you had low levels of lending. It must have had some impact, I think. And so this change in the narrative towards easing regulation, I think, has got to be supportive of lending going mm-hmm. forward.
And what are the other factors?
So the other factors are general animal spirits, how positive people are on the outlook for the world, right? Which is probably a little dampened in the mm-hmm. UK at the moment. And interest rates coming down. And the fact that their balance sheets are just that much better than they were 15 years ago.
Yeah. Would you say there's an overhang of pessimism because of what people experienced back then?
Look, it's possible that there's an overhang of pessimism. But I think it's quite interesting to frame this argument in the context of optimism or pessimism, right? So in 2007 or 2008, private sector in the US was borrowing about 16% of GDP, right? To borrow more than 16% of GDP, you had to be extremely optimistic, right? Now they're borrowing 5% of GDP. The only times they've borrowed less than that are during the great financial crisis and after the savings and loans crisis in the early 90s. In the UK, for example, the borrowing level now is the same as it was when the UK had to go to the IMF for a loan in the mid-70s and when they got chucked out of the exchange rate mechanism in the early 90s. So these are levels of borrowing consistent with reasonably extreme pessimism. It's not to say people can't become more pessimistic, but they don't have to become that optimistic to borrow more.
Mm-hmm. And Rafa is famous for kind of capital preservation, hedging against disasters. How does a bullish credit revival fit into that kind of defensive DNA?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what Rafa really tries to do is to create an all-weather portfolio for you. So we absolutely don't want to lose your money, but we do want to take advantage of the opportunities. So as you say, there'll be a section of the portfolio that'll really be protecting against some kind of a recession, sort of collapse in growth. There'll be a section of the portfolio that's trying to protect against, say, a surge in inflation. And then there's a bit of the portfolio that's trying to take advantage of the growth opportunities. Now, if you've got some funds in sort of protection and inflation hedges, then what you want in the bit that's taking risk, you really want there to be asymmetric returns to this story. Now, I think given the pessimism you've spoken about, people are fairly, pessimistic about the outlook for a lot of domestic demand plays. And I think you see it in the prices, for example, in UK house builders, right? And so now we'd say from here, there's an asymmetry to the outcomes for these companies. If people get more pessimistic, if the Iran war continues, if interest rates go up, it's not going to be that easy for them. But it doesn't take much in terms of stabilization to see a rise in new borrowing, a positive credit impulse, and we think that would give an upside surprise to spending growth.
And just about your views now, what is the most contrarian position you have right now? What is the consensus missing that maybe you're seeing?
So, that's a tricky one at the moment because what's happening right now is the Iran war, right? And that's pushed oil prices up and that's slightly dominating the headlines. And I don't think I have a comparative advantage in how that's going to work out. So that's the dominant story. But if you have to take a step back from that, I think that this credit impulse argument is the non-consensus view. If interest rates manage to stabilize, or if oil prices manage to stabilize, you've got these large parts of the economy that have done poorly for 15 years, where new borrowing levels are very, very low. And people can buy into a sort of AI capex-led recovery. But if this argument is correct and interest rates stabilize, what you could get is a broadening out of that recovery. And you can see some of these more credit-sensitive areas of the economy outperforming people's expectations. And so if we get increasing visibility on what's happening to oil in Iran, I think that will be the non-consensus view. That's where we can maybe gain sort of outsized returns.
Yeah. And if your thesis does play out, What does that mean for risk assets?
So if the credit impulse is positive, you get above trend growth. You get above trend growth, you get a support for earnings growth. You know, you get a support for earnings growth, that tends to be good for risk assets. Mm-hmm. And while real rates probably won't come down in that environment, they might even shift up. I think the equity risk premium will narrow and earnings growth will be strong. So it'll be a good environment for risk assets.
And kind of the bottom line for wealth managers listening right now, how should they be positioning their client portfolios for this kind of shift?
Look, you know, their positioning is going to be very much a function of what they think is happening to oil and Iran and the like. But what this argument would say, because new borrowing is very low in places like the US and the UK, it's not that easy for it to fall a lot further. So these economies should be more resilient than you anticipate, right? And if you get some stabilization in rates, the increase in new borrowing, the positive credit impulse could give you stronger growth than you anticipate, this broadening in the recovery. And so when you feel slightly more reassured about some of the risks you're facing, I think trying to be exposed to those trends can provide profitable investment opportunities.
And what is the one lesson you think those wealth managers should take away from this podcast?
That's a tricky question. So what I'm going to say is, I'm going to take a step back. There's this great quote from an economist called Kolesky who said, I found out what economics is. It's the science of confusing stocks and flows. And the high-level stories don't confuse the stocks and flows.
Well, that seems like a good point to end on. Thank you so much for joining us, Mike, and we will see you next time on The Wealth Show.
Thank you very much for having me.
But today is VE Day. The war is
over. The newly crowned queen waves from the Belt.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.